Tonight we're going to kind of slow down. I know the last few nights we've just been just plowing through, especially last night. It was kind of like two sermons. I mean, there's a natural conclusion in the middle of that sermon. I don't know, you know, if you listen to it again, maybe you'd pick it up. I pick it up. I know that it's there, and there's a perfect place for it to come to a conclusion, and then there's part B. There's the second side to it. And so I know that, you know, some of these could have been stretched out a little bit further, or they could have been broken up a little bit better. But there's a lot that we want to try to get through to frame all of what's happening in, because there's a cumulative point that's being built to. And tonight we want to talk about what it is to truly be great, our commitment, to have truly great commitment. But like I said, tonight we're going to slow that down somewhat. But what I'd really like for you to be able to take away from it, it's not possible for me to cover the entirety of Matthew. And as I've mentioned several times already this week, that if Matthew, one book in the Bible, the first book of the New Testament, but just one book in the Bible, 28 chapters, if there's this much in it, just think of all that's in the Bible entirely. And I'll tell you, if I can't do anything more for you than this, I hope that in my passion and my love for what God has wrote and what He has sent down through the generations for, I hope that you will be moved to dig these things out for yourself. Go and find out what's in there. It is life-changing stuff. And so go find what's in the Bible. It is just powerful. It's wonderful. It will recreate you. That is God's power for renewal. And I hope that you'll find it. I hope that you'll see it. And I hope that you can join with me and give an amen and thank the Lord for His Word. But tonight, like I said, we're going to talk about great commitment. Great commitment is our study this evening. And just to kind of catch us up again, we want to think that we have been on this journey with Matthew, and I know that it's been somewhat sporadic, but I think we've put enough of the pieces in there that I think you'll be able to see this. I'll tell you, if you want to think about Matthew any next week, go look at those last few chapters from chapter 20 onward, where Jesus rides in on the donkey and He pronounces Himself King, and just look at what He does. It is just amazing stuff. But tonight we want to think about what we have covered so far through the book of Matthew. People have come to believe, and this is really the way I think Matthew breaks this stuff up. There are these five major discussions in Matthew, but you have in the first half of Matthew, you have the discussion of Jesus' identity. And just to kind of maybe give some bullet points on that, you have in chapter 8, where Jesus calms the sea, His disciples are in the ship, Jesus in the ship, Jesus asleep, the storm blows up, and remember that at least four of these men, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, these are fishermen, and they are fishermen on this very sea. They are used to these boats. They are used to this sea. They are used to weather on this sea. And even those men say, I'm scared out of my mind. You might want to take them serious. They know what they're talking about. This is a bad storm. Right? When the old sea hand is scared, it's a bad storm. And so when they wake Jesus up, do you not care that we are perishing? We're going to die, Jesus. And Jesus, with a word, with just a word, calms the storm. And all is peace. Just think about the metaphor that's there. Jesus' word, God's word, brings peace to the storms that rage. And the disciples ask, what sort of man, what manner of man is this that even the winds and waves obey His voice? And that's the whole point. He's not just a man. But they ask those kinds of questions. You have when Jesus casts out the legion of demons and the people are frightened by Jesus and they ask Jesus to depart. And of course, later on, it's interesting that Jesus comes back to that same area. He comes back to that same region. They're afraid of him here in chapter 8, but he comes back in chapter 14 and they welcome him by bringing him all the sick and all the diseased and the demon possessed so that Jesus can do something about it. You have to wonder if it doesn't have a good deal to do with the possessed man who was healed, who was delivered by Jesus, and his evangelism, his preaching, his sharing the message of what Jesus had done. You have to wonder about that. But why are they? Why did they ask him to leave? This is Jesus. You think about what he can do. Why would you want this guy to leave? What could be going through their minds? Why would they ask him to leave? He has healed this man. Why would they ever ask him to leave? Why would you? Well, it may be because they don't understand this kind of power. Somebody that strong, somebody that powerful, while he has done something good, he might get out of control and he might do something really bad. They're scared of him. You have the forgiving of sins. You know, which is easier to say? Take up your bed and go home, or your sins are forgiven, so that you may know that. John's question, you have all these things that are building this identity of Jesus. Who is this Jesus that we're talking about? The reaction in chapter 12 of the Pharisees, and then finally Peter's confession in chapter 16 and verse 16. And then last night, we went from talking about who Jesus is to talking about Jesus' means. It's not enough to simply believe in Jesus. We believe in Jesus, but you got to go Jesus' way. Following the footsteps of Jesus. And Jesus' steps carry a cross and they carry them to crucifixion. That's God's way. And it may not seem like that's the way to win. Dying doesn't seem like the way to win. But what does the Bible say so often, over and over and over? The first shall be last and the last shall be first. Those that wish to save their life will lose it. But if you lose your life for my name or for my sake, you are the ones that truly find it. You have all of these kinds of, it seems upside down to the mind of the world, to the fleshly mind, to the carnal mind. It seems upside down, but it's simply because this world is upside down. Jesus foretells his death. And this is all the stuff that we talked about last night. And so this evening, what we're going to see is now we believe in Jesus' definition of commitment. Now, will we trust Jesus' definition of what it means to be committed? Are you committed to Jesus? I mean, we believe in Jesus, right? We believe in Jesus, and I understand Jesus' path means the cross. And so if that's the way that I must go, then give me the biggest cross there is. Because I want Jesus to know that I'm committed to Him. Give me the biggest and thorniest of crosses. I want Him to know that I'm committed. What does it mean to truly be committed to Jesus? That's what we want to think about tonight. Because I know, if you're here, you've been here all week. I know that you're committed to Jesus. But what does Jesus see as commitment? Again, sometimes we get things turned upside down because this world and the mind of the world, the fleshly mind, it is itself upside down. What does heaven see as true and great commitment? That's our discussion for this evening. So, the scenario opens with James and John, and they want to be great. So let's open our Bibles together tonight to Matthew chapter 20 and read a few of these verses. Matthew chapter 20, and we're going to pick up in verse 20 and we're going to go down through verse 8. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 20. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit on your right and one on your left." But Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink?" And they said to him, "We are able." Now let me ask you, Jesus had just said to the mother and also to the sons here that you do not know what you're asking. Do you think that all of a sudden they got some amount of clarity that they now do know what they were asking for? And so when Jesus says, are you able to drink this cup? Do you think they know what cup he's talking about? What mug is it, Jesus? I mean, what cup are you talking about? You know, is it what are we drinking? Water or grape juice? What are we drinking today? I don't care. The point is, whatever you're drinking, Jesus, I'll drink it. It doesn't matter what it is. Wherever you go, I'm going. You don't have to tell me where. I am that committed to you. That's the whole point. It's not that they understand anything more. They don't. They don't know what they're talking about. All they know is, I'm going where he's going. That's what they're saying. We are committed to you. And he said to them, my cup, verse 23, my cup you shall drink, but to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those to whom it has been prepared by my Father. And hearing this, the 10 became indignant with the two brothers, but Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Now notice that the other disciples, that they're angry with Jesus, and you have to wonder, maybe they're angry with Jesus because they didn't think to ask the question first. You know, I didn't know you were handing those places out, Jesus. I mean, if we were getting to call dibs on shotgun in the kingdom, I would have called first. I just didn't know that that was up for grabs. So maybe that's why they're angry. And I say that. I know that that's not explicitly said, but again, these are regular people. These are people like you and I. And I'll tell you, that would have been my thought. That would have been the way I would have thought about it. I didn't know. If I knew that we could ask, I would have asked. And now I'm mad because I lost my chance. But they're angry with the brothers. And the disciples, they've often argued about who was the greatest. And again, that's what John and James are saying. We want to show you that we truly are committed to you. Peter does the same kind of thing. Even if I have to die with you, I'll go with you. Now we see that he fails later, but it's his commitment. He's committed. Wherever you go, I'll go with you. And James and John are saying the same thing. Jesus, it doesn't matter what the cup is. It doesn't matter what's in the cup. If it's Kool-Aid, I'll drink the Kool-Aid with you. It doesn't matter. If you drink it, Jesus, I'll drink it. If it's not a cup, I don't care what it is. Wherever you go, I'll go with you. You just lead the way. I'm with you. I've got your back. I'm on your six. Nothing's going to get between us. That's their commitment. That's all that's happening here. But they've often argued about these kinds of things. And there's a number of passages here. Matthew talks about it, Mark talks about it, Luke talks about it. It's all the same event in these various passages. But notice that all these gospel writers mention this same thing, this same happening. They're arguing about who is greatest. That's a big deal in the gospel record. But what the one I want you to focus on is this one in chapter 22 and verse 24. Because notice that this is another occasion in the gospel of Luke. The reason why this one is so important is because of what's happening in that chapter or what is just about to take place. You remember what it is? Think about it. There's 24 chapters in the book of Luke. You got to get to the point where Jesus is resurrected, and before he's resurrected, what has to happen? He has to die on the cross. You got to fit that in there after chapter 22. I mean, we're already at verse 24, right? So what's just about to happen when they're arguing about who's the greatest? What's Jesus about to do? He's about to die for those very men. The ones that are arguing about who's the greatest amongst themselves are doing it at the very moment that Jesus is just about to lay down his life for them, to show them what real greatness is. That it's truly about serving even the least of the people of this world. That's what Jesus is about to do when they're arguing about which one of them is most important. You know, every one of the 12 disciples would have felt that they were worthy of the title of greatest in the kingdom. If they're arguing about this, it's not just James and Peter arguing about which one of them is the greatest. They're all arguing about it. And if they are all arguing about it, don't they all have a case to make? It may not be a good case, but they've all got a case to make. When you were kids, did you ever argue with your siblings or with your neighbors? Did you ever argue with other kids? Did you always have a good and rational argument to make? No, we were kids. Did that stop us from arguing with them? No. Every one of them would have had a reason to feel that they were the greatest. Put yourself in their shoes. What would they have said? If you were them, what would you say? What would be evidence of you being the greatest in the kingdom? Think about Andrew. Andrew's one of these he's named, but he's not really paid much attention to. We get Peter and John in the first part of Acts. We get Peter somewhat after that, and then we get Paul. Andrew's really not there. And yet Andrew's involved in this. Andrew's arguing that he's the greatest of the disciples. He's not just top tier, but he's the greatest. He is the most important. He's the most valuable. What possibly could he have said that would have been reason to take that title or to have take that honor? What could he have possibly said? I don't know for sure. But if I was Andrew, this is the way I would have argued at least. Well, he could have said that he had the original status. Remember that it's Andrew and John that were originally disciples of John the Baptist. And they see John proclaim Jesus and they immediately follow Jesus. He has original status. I was the first of the disciples of Jesus. And besides that, number two, everybody knows that Peter's important. Peter would have never got here without me. That seems like a reasonable case to me. Reasonable enough, right? Andrew seems like a pretty important guy now that you look at it, right? Or what about the other guys? Of course, these are the important guys. Peter, James, and John. What would they have said? Well, they had a lot of things to say, right? They could have said, well, we were the ones that were singled out by Jesus. I mean, all the 12, we are all important because, you know, Jesus has the multitudes, but then Jesus has the 70, but then Jesus has the 12, right? Just like the 12 patriarchs of the Old Testament, we are the 12 disciples. And we are the three. I mean, Jesus took us up on the mountain. We can't tell you what happened there, but it was awesome. I mean, how much better does that make the case when you say, it was so good I can't even tell you about it? It's top secret stuff. I mean, doesn't that elevate your place, your position, your ability to argue that you are really important? How about this guy? What would you say about Judas? I mean, everybody knows Judas is the bad guy, but Judas is in this mix too. Judas is arguing that he's the greatest. What would Judas have said? I'll tell you what. If we can't identify with those guys, and I think if we really think about it, if we really pondered on this, I think we could see how we sometimes argue this very same kind of thing. We may not phrase it exactly because we are not walking in Jesus' footsteps in Galilee, but we say these same kinds of things today. We wrestle about who really is important in the church or in the brotherhood. We wrestle about these things. We may be a bit more covert about it, but we wrestle about these kinds of things. But what would Judas have said? If we can't identify with Andrew or Peter or James or John, I'll tell you what, we can identify with Judas. What makes Judas think he's most important? It's really simple. He has the money. He's got the money. No, enough said. That, I mean, he'd have just walked out. He'd have dropped the checkbook. There it is. Argument settled. I got the money. Every one of them had evidence to argue that they were the most important. Which one was? Let's talk about greatness and great commitment. Peter mentions to Jesus earlier that they had left everything. And this kind of ties in with what we were talking about last night. If you remember, the last of these examples that we find is where Jesus meets the young ruler and he tells him that what you're really lacking is that there's something that's standing between you and the Lord, and what that is it's your riches. You need to divest yourself of it. And I don't know if it's the money itself or if it's the prestige that the money brings. And if you divest yourself of the prestige, that's really what you're holding on to. I'm not sure which one it is, but Jesus says that you need to sell what you have, give it to the poor, come follow me. And he goes away sorrowful because he owned much property. It was not something that he could let go of. Now, again, like we mentioned last night, that may not be the problem that you have. But if you think back over your course of your life, do you ever notice that the very things that you crave the very most of all, those things that you can't stop thinking about are oftentimes the very things that you are so often denied? It's this that's standing in his way. And Jesus tells him in verse 21 to go and sell all your possessions, give it to the poor, and come follow me. Now notice verse 27 then. Peter says to him, behold, Jesus, look at this. We did leave everything and follow you. You just told the ruler to go and sell everything he had and come follow you. We did that. I mean, we really are committed to you, Jesus. We've done the work. We've done the stuff that we were supposed to do. They'd left their income. Matthew as a tax collector. The four as businessmen in fishing. They left those things. I don't know if they're drawing some kind of residual income. I don't know. Maybe they're just living off the charity of those women that follow them around. I don't know what it is. Maybe they're just really living on the cheap. But they have left their business, their livelihoods to follow Jesus. They are committed. That rich man, he was not committed. Peter's saying, Jesus, we are committed to you. And we're going to die with you. Notice the times that they do this. Over in Matthew 20 and verse 22. That very thing that Peter or James and John, what they're talking about here about, again, drinking this drink, drinking from the cup. They don't know what that cup is. It doesn't matter what the cup is. Jesus, if you're talking about drinking cyanide, we'll drink it. If you're talking about preaching in China, we'll go to China. It doesn't matter what it is that you're talking about. I don't have to know. I just know that you're doing it. And if you're doing it, I'm doing it because I'm with you. That's the commitment level of these men. And all the disciples, they make this same sort of case. Later on, they make the same sort of argument. When Jesus is talking about dying, and you'll remember that Peter says that even if I have to die with you, I'll not deny you. And all the disciples say the same thing, right? All the disciples make the same case. We can go to all these passages, chapter 26 or Luke 22. All of these passages, they're making this kind of case. John chapter 13 and verse 37. In verse 36, Peter had said to him, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus answered, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow me later. And Peter's response is, again, the same response. If you have this commitment, if you are committed to Jesus, just like these men are committed to Jesus, who wouldn't say the same thing that Peter says? Well, Jesus, if I got to go with you sometime, why can't I just go now? He said, Lord, why can't I not follow you right now? I'll lay my life down for you. It doesn't matter how dangerous it is. It doesn't matter how scary it is. You don't have to protect me from those things. I'll go with you. These men are committed to Jesus. John, go back to chapter 11. This is with Thomas. You remember the what is Thomas known as? Doubting Thomas, right? Doubting Thomas. Just kind of a side note. Thomas is called Didymus at times. Some think that the name Didymus means that he was a twin. And that may very well possibly be. But it's interesting, the nicknames that these men have, like Didymus, does it mean that he was a twin? Or that he has dual mindsets? It's kind of like Peter. Peter's the nickname, right? Cephas is his name, but Peter's his nickname. What does Peter mean? Everybody knows it means rock, right? What kind of rock is he, though? That really is the question in Peter's life, isn't it? What kind of rock are you? Are you a strong foundational rock? I'm not making the case that in chapter 16 that Jesus is saying that Peter is the rock. But Ephesians, Paul mentions that the church was founded upon the apostles and prophets. Are you this foundational rock, the solid rock? Are you this bedrock? Or are you a heap of gravel? Which are you? Are you strong, unmovable? Or are you, can you just be knocked over? That's the question in Peter's life. Didymus is similar to that. It's a nickname. It's similar to that. You have this man that has dual minds. And you see that here. You have him doubting later, right? I'll not believe until I see the nail prints in his hand and thrust my hand into the spear's pierce in his side. But what does he do here? This is a triumph here of faith. They'd just been run out of Jerusalem, and Jesus says, we're going back to Jerusalem, guys. And the other disciples say, Lord, Lord, they were just now seeking to kill you. Verse 16. Therefore, Thomas, who was called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go so that we may die with him. Now, is this a snarky kind of response? Maybe, but it appears to me the way that I read this verse is Thomas is saying, hey guys, wherever Jesus goes, that's what we bought into. Wherever Jesus goes, that's where we're going. If Jesus is going to Jerusalem, if he's going down, I'm going down with him. Blaze of Glory, Butch Cassidy and all that stuff, we're going down together. They're committed to Jesus, even if it means that they have to die with him. Every one of these, it's not just Peter. It's all of them. They're all committed. James and John and Thomas, they're all committed to him. I'll tell you, I want to do big things for the Lord. I want to be able to tell God, God, I'm committed to you. I love you. And when I sing Footsteps of Jesus, and it talks about preaching in temples holy, I want to be able to sing that. Let me go preach to the multitudes. Then it also says that thing about, or in the homes of the meek and lowly. Footsteps of Jesus, wherever He goes, I want to be able to honestly and truthfully open my heart to the Lord and say, Lord, see if these things are not so. I want to be able to say, wherever you go, I'll go with you. I'm committed to you. See, I want to do big things for God. I'm going to cut out a couple illustrations I have a hard time faulting these men for arguing about who was most important. Because even knowing that I'm not very important in the scheme of the world, I still want to be important in however way I can be. I just want to be as important as I can be important. And I'll tell you, I don't think it's a shame for me to confess that. I struggle with this matter of pride and ambition. And again, I don't think it's a shame for me to admit that to you. I am a sinner. If I haven't mentioned that already this week, let me remind you, I am a sinner. I am weak and I am broken and I need the forgiveness of God. It's not a shame for me to come here and to confess to you that I am a sinner. And one of the things that tempts me is pride, ambition, importance, greatness, whatever it may be. I'll tell you what would scare me, though, is if I tried to pretend that those things did not exist. When I was a kid, I remember talking with this other young kid. We're both teenagers, you know. And I remember we were learning how to preach and just learning how to open and read out of the Bible, you know, without, you know, messing all over the text. You know, I thought, oh, I'm going to be this great debater someday. I'm never going to be a great debater. I can't even debate with my kids. I can't argue with my kids and win. I just have to say, look, you be quiet. I'm going to talk now. And, you know, I just have to pull the dad card to win the argument. You know, it's just, I'm not fast enough to do that kind of stuff. I recognize that now. I used to think that great preachers are in great big churches and they have lots of meetings. You know, I used to think that, and some of this is a little challenging because my dad's here, and some of this has to do with the difference in the way that you think as an adult and the way that you think as a child. But I remember Dad preached in small churches for as long as I can remember, and I remember being frustrated with him, especially when he had opportunity to go to larger areas, larger cities, larger churches. I remember being frustrated as a child with him not doing that. I also remember he wanted to come and preach in Nebraska years ago, and in a small church in the state of very few churches. And I guess we were all pretty well all set against that. We did not want to go to an even smaller church. But it was these kinds of things, thinking that's the way that it was. Now, of course, as an adult, I don't think that's the case anymore. I think where I am right now, it's a small church, but I think in a lot of ways it's the very best place for my children and for myself to be. And I've told countless people that I think it was God's providence, and there's no way that I could nail that down and say God absolutely did this. But I truly believe the way things fall into place, that it was God's providence that brought us there. And I am constantly thankful for that. But you know, there's a problem with the other side of this now. Because now I recognize, oh, that's childish thinking. The problem comes then when I begin to boast that I recognize how childish and immature all of that thinking was. You see, now I'm mature. Now I know better. You see, now I'm happy to preach for just a few in the homes of the meek and lowly, as the song says. Oh, see, that's a badge of honor now. See the danger? There's a maybe you've read this book. This is in a lot of ways, I think Lewis is just a genius. And his genius, Mere Christianity is okay. That's the one a lot of people start with. Mere Christianity is okay. He writes a lot of other things beyond the stuff that he just does with religious texts and the Chronicles of Narnia. But his genius is seen in the Screwtape Letters. And the Screwtape Letters is fictional, of course, but what he's doing is he's trying to update, I don't know, maybe he's not trying to do this, but what he's doing is he's updating Dante's Divine Comedy and the Seven Levels of Hell. He's picturing hell as a bureaucracy. a company, if you will. And you have this greater demon, and he's writing to his nephew. You have this greater demon, Screwtape, he's writing to his nephew about how to carry on business. And their business is the tempting and consuming of souls. It's fascinating, this man's insight into our thinking. I want to read this one passage to you. It's out of chapter 14. The elder demon is writing to the younger demon about how to tempt us, the patient. He says, "I see only one thing to do at the moment. Your patient, the person, has become humble. You have you drawn his attention to that fact? All virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware that he has them. But this is especially true of humility. Catch him at the moment when he is really poor in spirit and smuggle into his mind the gratifying reflection, 'I'm being humble.' And almost immediately, pride. Pride at his own humility will appear. If he awakes to the danger and tries to smother this new form of pride, make him proud of his attempt," and so on. Through as many stages as you please. Don't try this too long for fear you'll wake his sense of humor in proportion, in which case he'll merely laugh at you and go to bed. What brilliant insight. Oh, I want to do big things for God, but I can't do big things for God because I'm not that big. And so I must really be important because I get to do all the little things, the important things that we couldn't do without them anyway, so somebody's got to do that. And that's me. And it's all pride, isn't it? It's all pride. Who's the greatest? Who's the most important? Well, what Jesus says is the greatest of us serve the most unimportant among us. Read these verses with me, if you will. Again, Matthew chapter 20. Matthew 20 and verse 25. So Jesus calls the disciples to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them." What does that mean? The rulers of the Gentiles, this is the way they behave, and what do? They make sure everybody know who is the boss. That's what it means. They're making sure everybody knows who the boss is. "And their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." You know, there's a principle here. The way that we treat God's people is the way that we are, in fact, treating God. We see this kind of thing in Matthew 25, where Jesus is picturing the great judgment scene, and "When I was hungry, you did not give me something to eat. When I was thirsty, you did not give me something to drink. When I was a stranger, you didn't take me in. Naked, you didn't clothe me." And the wicked say, "Well, when did we see you in that condition and not supply these things to you?" And Jesus' simple response is, "To the extent that you did not do it to the least of these, my brethren, you did not do it to me." The way that we treat God's people, and especially even the least, those most ignored, we treat the Lord. Or how about this passage over in 1 John, 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4. And verse 20. "If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen." Why? Why? It's easy to say, "I love you," when I don't have to do anything for you. I can't do anything for God. God's not here. at least not in the body, he doesn't need food. He doesn't need me to get him clothing. He doesn't need a place to stay. What can I do for him? So when I say, I love God, what am I doing? The way that we treat God's people or the way that we treat Him, and that passage there in Acts 9 is about Paul persecuting. Why dost thou persecute me? In the sense that he persecuted God's people. So the question then is, finally, who does sit on the right and on the left of Jesus? I mean, that's the question that we started with. I know you've been aching for an answer. Who's going to sit on the right and on the left of Jesus? With all the things that we've talked about tonight, who is it? Is it still going to be Peter? Peter and Paul. Who is it? I don't know. I don't know. I'll tell you, if I guessed, if I had to guess, and that's all this is, if I had to guess, it's not going to be a preacher. No matter how many places he's preached, no matter how many meetings he's had, how many people he's baptized, not going to be a preacher. Probably not going to be any elders. If I had to guess, I'll tell you who I think it is. It's two little old unnamed women. That's who it is. Two little old unnamed women that nobody remembers except the other unnamed people that they served. God alone knows them. What is it to truly be great? I want to do big things for God. I want to do great things for God. And God says, listen, Ray, if you want to do big things for me, then just serve my people. The small ones. The insignificant. The forgotten. Serve those that can't do anything for you or anybody else. That is what it is to serve greatly. Is there anyone here tonight that wishes to name Jesus Christ as their Lord? Wherever He goes, to follow with Him. Would you repent of your sins? Give your life entirely and wholly over to Him? Would you be baptized for the forgiveness of those sins tonight? We're ready and able to help you in all the ways that we can. If you come, always stand and sing.